You guys to open up to Genesis chapter 11. And once you get there, it'll take us 2 or 3 minutes to get there. Just let that Bible sit in your lap or put your bulletin in there and close it up again so you've got it marked. While you're turning to Genesis 11 and kind of finding your place, I want to kind of be a little vulnerable with you guys today. I'm going to tell you what my middle name is. Now, the reason that's a little bit vulnerable is that when I was a young kid, not like every day or every year, but off and on, I got teased about my middle name. Now, I don't think it's that funny of a middle name. But apparently, some of my classmates and neighborhood playmates thought that, you know, there was something humorous about it. The reason I like my middle name is that I was given my middle name after my grandfather's first name. And my grandfather's first name is my own father's middle name, if you're kind of tracking with this. My parents gave me the same middle name as my dad, and my wife and I gave Jared, one of our two sons, the same middle name. Well, the name is Lawrence, which I think is kind of nice. It's kind of classical, traditional, but if you can imagine, and little boys would come across Lawrence and just have a heyday with it. There's a second kind of link between my grandfather and myself and one day my own son Jared, and that is that my wedding band belonged to my grandfather, so that got passed down. So when my son Jared gets married, he'll have this wedding band, and Carla and I guess we'll have to go out and just find me a little cheap, you know, basic band to replace it. But I love this whole idea of tradition. And if you pull your sermon notes out, if you like following along and filling in the blanks, that's actually our first fill in the blank. That people in Bible days, they cared deeply about tradition. In fact, things really haven't changed all that much in 4,000 years. If we go back to the days of Abraham and Genesis. So let's look at Genesis 11. What I'll do is start reading at verse 24. And if you don't have a Bible, this will come up on the side screens. By the way, I'm going to pronounce these names as they're pronounced for the most part in Hebrew, so I don't do that to try to impress you guys. I studied Hebrew in grad school, and I'm used to it, so it's actually hard for me to pronounce it otherwise. It's kind of like somebody that speaks Spanish. You don't expect them to switch out and pronounce a name like, you know, gringos might pronounce it. So if they say J-U-A-N, they're not going to say Juan, they're going to say Juan, right? So please don't think I'm trying to be real special by giving them a different pronunciation. So starting at verse 24, Nahor lived 29 years and became the father of Terah. And Nahor lived 119 years after he became the father of Terah. And he had other sons and daughters. Terah lived 70 years and became the father of Avram, Nahor, and Haran. Now, if you're looking at that, you may have noticed already what I'm going to point out. But let's look at these generations for a minute here. We start with Nahor. He's generation one. He has a son, Terah. And Terah has three sons, Avram, who later becomes Abraham. He gets renamed. Nahor and Haran. So if you haven't picked it up yet, let's highlight some words. Verse 24 is Nahor. So he's the grandfather, right? He has a son. The son has three sons. These are the three grandsons. The three grandsons are Avram, Nahor. There's the second time that that name appears. And Haran. But in verse 26, do you see that it's not the same Nahor 2 verses previous? So what's happened? Same thing as me and my grandfather on my father's side. Except here it's first names. The grandson got named after the grandfather. Guess what? Things have not changed in 4,000 years. People still like tradition. We like change. We like new experiences. We like innovation. We probably wouldn't like it if 20 years from now, this church, the sanctuary, the screens, the instruments all looked exactly the same. We probably wouldn't like that. But nor would we like things if we walked in here next week and it's completely different. The chairs are all gone. We're sitting on the floor. There's neon green paint all over the walls, and there's something strange up here aside from instruments. We wouldn't like that either. So God has created us as human beings to like tradition and innovation at the same time. And we're looking at the tradition side in the Bible this morning. So what we're going to talk about today are genealogies. That's kind of a scholar's term. So we're going to call them family trees, which is a term I like better anyway. And as we look at these things in the Bible, it's kind of interesting because at first glance, maybe at second glance too, these are really boring. A family tree is a list of names, basically. In fact, one of our elders a few weeks ago said, these are the parts of the Bible that you skim read or you skip because you can't pronounce the names. But even if you could, what do you get out of it? It's just a bunch of names and some line of ancestors that has no application to our lives, to our day, to our time. So we're going to call them family trees, and our first question in your sermon notes is, how do we read a family tree? So how do we study it? How do we interpret it? How do we understand it? There are maybe, six or seven rules or principles when you're looking at a family tree, and I'm just going to give you two, but I think they're the most important two today. The first one is, and this is a fill in the blank if you like taking notes, a family tree has structure. So a family tree or a genealogy has structure. And we're going to turn all the way to the New Testament, to Matthew chapter 1, for an example of that. So first book of the New Testament, very first chapter, just like Genesis 11, is a family tree. It's a bunch of names. Again, at first glance, man, what does this have to do with me? I want to get onto a parable that Jesus says, or a miracle that he performs, or a little mini sermon that he gives where there's some teaching. I don't want to read through dozens and dozens of names of guys in the Old Testament. After all, they're not my ancestors. Well, almost all of Matthew 1 is a genealogy. Let me read just the first verse for you. The record of the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. In that verse, maybe the most important word is Messiah, but maybe after that, the second most important word would be David. It comes right after Messiah, the son of David. So I'm going to give you all a little crash course in Hebrew here, or at least a few minutes on a few letters, not the whole alphabet. We're going to look on the side screens at the name David, and we're going to look at it in Hebrew script. I'm going to kind of walk you through how this works because it'll help us with the structure of Matthew chapter 1. David is written in three letters. Hebrew doesn't write vowels. It only writes consonants. The vowels are the A, E, I, O, U, if you can't remember from your elementary school days. So we've really just got D, V, and D. Hebrew goes right to left. If you look at the chicken scratches up there, the D is like the upside down uppercase L. For us. Or another way of looking at it is, it's kind of like a roof, a real thick roof, and then there's a wall on one side, but no wall on the other side. But maybe think of it as capital L flipped upside down. The next letter is the V sound in Hebrew. That's like a stick, maybe a shepherd's crook, a stick with a little cap on top. And then you'll see that the third letter is the same as the first one. So all of that put together is David. Now, here's the last thing to learn about the name. Hebrew didn't have a separate number of symbols for numbers. So think about it. We have an alphabet, and we have a number system. I'm trying to think. I think it's called the Arabic number system. Some like school teacher helped me out here. Is that what it's called? All right. So we've got the Arabic system of numbers and then the alphabet system. So Hebrew didn't have a separate system for numbers. And when you think about it, they really didn't need one, because they used their alphabet. The D sound is the fourth letter of the Hebrew alphabet. Therefore, if you saw the letter, it's called Dalet, that chicken scratch like the upside down L, sitting by itself, not other letters around it, you would know it's the number four. So we're
going to pretend you're in Israel. You're digging up stuff in an archaeological dig. You come across a piece of parchment or a broken piece of pottery, and it's got Hebrew letters on it, and you see Dalet, the upside-down L, by itself. In other words, thinking of a keyboard, there's a space before it, space after it. You would just know that's the number 4. Maybe it's a shopping list a mom gave her son. Go pick me up 4 eggs at the marketplace. Here, I'm going to write it down so you don't forget. And there it is, the number 4. Vav, the V sound, is the 6th letter. Therefore, it's 6. And then there's another D. Well, every once in a while, it's real rare, but every once in a while, you can look at somebody's name and add up the numeric equivalents of the letters and come up with a total, and it actually means something in the text. In this case, you add those up, it comes to 14. I'll show you in a minute why that's significant in Matthew chapter 1. But let me put out a word of caution here. This is real, real rare. People have written whole books about Bible codes and hidden numeric equivalents of names, and it's 99.9% false. Just hogwash, just stuff they're finding on their own. But this is one of the rare instances where it probably does mean something. And let me show you why. If you've got a Bible, this won't be on the side screen, but you could look down at verse 17 of Matthew chapter 1. All the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David to the deportation to Babylon, 14 generations. And from the deportation to Babylon to the Messiah, 14 generations. So what is the structure of Matthew chapter 1? It's based around the number 14, which in turn is based on the total of the 3 letters of David's name. Probably done in part to help people memorize this thing. Now, I'm not going to recommend you go home and memorize Matthew chapter 1. There's probably more important things to memorize. Nothing else. Memorize Psalm 23 and Psalm 100 and parts of the Sermon on the Mount. This would be maybe last on my list of things to memorize. But in ancient days, they memorized tons of stuff, what we would consider hundreds and hundreds of pages. And this was a help to them when they did that. In fact, just to kind of confirm this, let's go through the first set of 14. I'll ask you to watch the side screens as we do this. So I'll start reading at verse 2. Abraham was the father of Isaac. So Abraham's going to be generation number 1. And then we read on, Isaac, the father of Jacob. So Isaac is going to be number 2. Jacob, the father of Yehudah and his brothers. So then we've got Yehudah or Judah, who's going to be number 4. Yehudah was the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez, so he's going to be, where are we now, 5th, was the father of Hezron. Hezron, who's going to be number 6, is the father of Ram. Ram, number 7, the father of Amminadav. Amminadav, number 8, the father of Nachshon. Nachshon, number 9, the father of Salmon. Salmon, he's going to be number 10, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahav. And then Boaz, number 11, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, who's number 12, was the father of Jesse. Jesse, number 13, was the father of King David, number 14. Sure enough, 14 from the beginning to David. Like we saw, another 14 from David to Babylon. That's a major turning point in Israel's history. 14 from Babylon to, here we are, Matthew chapter 1, birth of Jesus the Messiah. So Matthew chapter 1 definitely has a structure to it. Go all the way back to Genesis 5, and we'll stay here for the rest of the morning. We'll see one more example of structure, because remember, our first rule is look for the structure in a family tree. In fact, Genesis 5 is the first family tree that you come across in the whole Bible. It's kind of a minor one in Genesis 4, but this is the first real kind of full-fledged one. I'll start reading at verse 6. Seth lived 105 years and became the father of Enosh. Then Seth lived 807 years after he became the father of Enosh, and he had other sons and daughters. All the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. Verse 9, Enosh lived 90 years And guess what? We start the cycle all over again. So if you look at that for a minute, either in the Bible or up on the side screens, you've got Seth living so many years. Let's call him A. Let's go right to the formula. And this really is something you can kind of map out like something in math. If Seth is A, A lives so many years, becomes the father of B, that was Enosh. And then we go back to A, that was Seth, he lives so many more years. Then we get a total number of years for letter A, and then he dies. And then we go on to B, and then C, D, E, F, all the way through Genesis 5. So is there a structure to Genesis 5? Wow, there sure is. And we can even put it out in a formula. So by now you might be saying, okay, Ron, so what? So there's structure in family trees. What's the big deal? So that leads us to rule number two, our second and final rule about reading family trees. And this is in your sermon notes. Rule number two is look for breaks in the structure. So once you know what the structure is, you can look for places where the author breaks away from that. And there's a great way of illustrating this, not so much from our time, but from 2 centuries ago, actually. In the 1800s, even in the 1700s, there was this neat, neat thing that I kind of wish would get resurrected. And it was called a family Bible. And the family Bible was this big, thick, honking, heavy weight King James Bible. Would stay in your living room. I mean, I don't think you'd take it to church, although some families only had one Bible and they had to take that to church. But it would usually stay in your home, be protected from the weather, the elements. And this is what was cool about the family Bible. In the first few pages, it had a family tree. And it might have looked a little bit like that. Actually, most family trees, and it really was a picture of a tree, by the way, were bigger than this and more complex. So the rectangular boxes of white space that you could write in were usually 2 to 3 times the number that are on the side screens, and they'd branch out more to the left and the right. And this was one page or sometimes two facing pages. And I think you get the idea here. You start with as far back as you can go. So I'm going to do this from the perspective of, say, a family in Virginia, because my wife and I lived in Virginia for 18 years. So let's say somebody comes over on a ship from Europe in the early 1800s. Whether it's a guy or a married couple, you put that single name or sometimes both names in the trunk of the tree at the bottom. And then you work up from that generation by generation. And you write only the person's name, their birth date, and their death date in the rectangle. Here's what's interesting. There's a thing called the Library of Virginia, kind of like the Library of Congress, but on the state level. And they had a project going in the 1990s, and it's probably still going. And the project went like this. They wanted to collect family trees of families from Virginia. So they put the word out, mostly in Virginia, but actually all over the country as much as they could, because they realized that people might, you know, whether it's late 1800s, sometime in the 1900s, move a family from Virginia to Michigan or California or New Mexico. So they put the word out. They said, if you think your family was from Virginia in the 1800s or 1700s, and second, if you've got a family Bible with the family tree, will you please take pictures of the family tree and will you email them in to us? And what we'll do on our part is we'll collect. It ended up being thousands of pictures of family trees from family Bibles. We'll collect these things. We'll post them up on a site so you can explore your family history. So let's make up a name, the Adams. So your family's last name is Adams. You live in New Mexico, but you know that your great-great-grandfather lived in Virginia and several generations before him lived in Virginia. And you've got a family Bible that was passed down to you. You're the kind of person they want to take digital pictures of that tree, both the whole thing and then zoom in on individual names and parts of the page, send it in. And then you can go to their site and say, I want, you put your last name in a search program, give me all the family trees of Adams who are from Virginia. And some might not be part of your family heritage, some might be. So you look at one that's somebody else's family Bible and you say, whoa, my great-great-grandfather, whom I know, is the same great-great-grandfather that this guy has. I didn't even know I was related to this guy who lives in Indiana, but we've got the same family history, and his goes back farther than what I can trace. Man, you'd really cherish that family tree if you cared about your family history. So here's what's really interesting. What Library of Virginia discovered was that people could not resist the temptation to write in extra notes on their family tree. So even though it really is very structured, you've got a rectangle that has enough room for a name, a birth date, a death date. And in fact, you'd usually just put B period for birth, D period for died, because you don't have that much space. Even given the structure, people could not resist maybe one out of every five generations writing an extra note in. Sometimes they'd squeeze it in the rectangle, and sometimes they'd put it right next to the rectangle. Usually the branches weren't that bushy and thick and crowded, so there'd be white space outside the rectangle you could write in. So let's say that somebody knows that their grandfather, they're writing this in the mid-1800s, they know their grandfather was governor of Virginia for 3 years. They'd write it in because they couldn't resist. You know, Jedediah Adams was governor of Virginia from 1813 to 1816. And you'd see this written in, just like we would at a little angle, right next to the rectangle. Well, that's what we have in the Bible. That's what God has put in the Bible for us to learn from. And that's how he's going to teach theological truth through genealogies. One way he'll do that. There's another name for this, and it's your next fill in the blank, and it's called out-of-sequence information. So a break in a structure, what's another name for that? An out-of-sequence piece of information. Why? Because you've got a sequence. We saw it. This is a formula to Genesis 5. But this is out of the sequence. It's a break from it. So I'm going to show you one of the best examples of out-of-sequence information. We're in Genesis 5. Let's look at verse 21. Enoch lived 65 years and became the father of Methuselah. Then Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Do you see how that's different? If nothing else, go home and read through all of Genesis 5. We saw Seth earlier. They're almost all like Seth, just real straightforward. A guy lives so many years, he has a son. He lives so many years after that. The total number of life is so many years. He dies. Then his son lives so many years, and he has a son. But here we've got a couple things. In verse 22, we've got that Enoch walked with God. And then it gets repeated in verse 24. And we don't read he died. We read that all of a sudden he was not. I mean, it's like I'm looking at Parker here in the front row, and then I look a minute later, and he's not there, but I know he hasn't gotten up and moved anywhere. His body doesn't exist. It's not alive. It's not dead on the floor. There's no magician that made him disappear. He's with God right now, and he's not with us anymore. He didn't see death like human bodies do. That's what happened, and that's definitely a break in the sequence, the structure of Genesis 5. So that draws our attention to this whole idea of walking with God. We don't read about the relationships of the other people in Genesis 5, but we read about Enoch. Wouldn't it be neat if decades from now, after you died, in fact, for some people in our congregation, for actually three that we as elders know of and have visited in the last couple weeks, for a few people in our congregation, this could actually be and probably will be in the next year, that in their 30s or 40s, I mean, long before dying of old age, they may be taken away from our congregation earlier than what we as human beings from our earthly plane would say their right time is. Wouldn't it be neat if whenever you die, people would say about you, that man or that woman walked with God. That man or that woman followed after Christ. Along with all the other things that they'll say, you know, good father, provided for his family, worked hard, great mother, sacrificed for her kids. Wouldn't it be neat if they put in something about Christ and God, just like Rick was able to tell us about his grandmother? So Enoch walked with God. Let's look at maybe one more thing in Genesis chapter 5. And that is that the number 7 comes into play in Genesis chapter 5. So a little review here. Earth was created in 6 days. God rests on the 7th. And that becomes the basis for our week that we still practice in the West, actually the whole world. A 7th day is a day of rest. And months are organized by weeks. Years are organized by weeks. Because of that, the number 7 in the Bible came to have a symbolic meaning of completeness or wholeness. Here's one of dozens of examples. Psalm 119, verse 164. The psalmist says, 7 times a day I praise you. Now, does that mean that he actually counted every day? Does that mean that he like had a scratch sheet of paper and when he got to 7 checks, he was done? No. What it means is, throughout the day, through the whole day, through the complete day, I praise you. In the morning when I get up, midday, afternoon, evening, late at night, 7 times, not once, not twice, not 3 times, throughout the day I praise you. Maybe some days it was 6 that were intentional, you know, direct praise. Maybe some days it was a dozen. But throughout the day, the psalmist says, I praise God. So that's our background. Let's count generations just out of interest from the beginning of, well, close to the beginning of chapter 5. We'll start with Adam, verse 3. And we'll just put this up on the side screen instead of reading all the verses. We've got Adam, his son is Seth. This is after Cain and Abel. Those might be the two sons you think about if you're familiar with Genesis. Then Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, and guess who's number 7? Enoch. It's probably intentional that he's the 7th generation. And we read about how special he was. We read about his relationship with God. All right, so that's our first big question. How do we read genealogies? We look for sequence and structure, and then we look for stuff that's out of sequence, because God's going to teach theology through that and probably give us examples that we should follow. Good examples we should model ourselves after, bad examples we should avoid. So our second and final big question is, what can we learn from all this? And there are really two things that we can learn. Number one is that our identity comes from before our time. Whether you like it or not, a huge part of who you are comes from your parents and your grandparents and your great-grandparents. So maybe there's a quick point of application here. Some of you probably should go home this afternoon and call your mother or father if you're not living with them. And most of us are older here, so I think very few of us are. Some of you, better yet, should actually write a letter. Do you guys remember what that is? It's like an art form that's been lost in email. People don't write letters anymore. They just don't. For some of you, it would mean the world to your mother or your father if you wrote them a letter. So imagine they're going out to their mailbox, and there's a letter there, and it's not, you know, direct mail. It's not an offer of a credit card. It's not some attempt to get you to buy into car insurance to save 10%. They see that it's hand addressed to them, and your address is handwritten, or maybe you've got one of those little sticky things. I can't remember what they're called. Little return address label. But they see it's from you, their son or their daughter. Man, they'd go home, they'd probably rip that thing open because you've taken time out of your day to not just whip on a keyboard a few sentences, but to handwrite out a letter to them. And what they're reading is what you remember about them and what you appreciate about them and how you see so many good qualities of them in your life and what you're thankful for. And you can do that whether your parents are followers of Christ or not. We're commanded to honor our parents. And if you remember, that command is not conditional. It doesn't have some tagline that says, honor your mother and father to the extent that they honor God. No, No, it doesn't. It just says honor them. A huge part of your identity comes from before your time, and family trees remind us of that. Second, our identity continues after our time. And this is actually the bigger and deeper point of application. You might have heard this before, but it's a good thing to think about. If someone were at your death to do a tombstone, but it's not just one or two lines, it's a paragraph, or to write an obituary for the paper, or better yet, if like Rick did, one of your grandchildren after your death was to come before a group of people and tell them about your life, what would they say? What would you want them to say? What do you think they would say if you died right now based on your life right now, this day, the present time? In family trees in the Bible, we read about people, actually good and bad. I'll give you one more example that you can kind of look at on your own. In Genesis 5, there's a guy named Lamech. It's spelled L-A-M-E-C-H. And he has an out-of-sequence piece of information. He actually talks. So you see double quote marks. If you remember the sequence, the formula we put up on the screens, these guys don't talk. A lives so many years, he has a son. Then he lives so many more years and he dies. Then the son lives so many years. They don't talk. Lamech has something to say. And it's very clear that Lamech is a godly father. And that's why he's quoted. In Genesis chapter 4, there's another guy named Lamech. Same name, different person. But if you read about the Lamech in Genesis 4, there's out-of-sequence information there. And it's very clear that the Lamech of Genesis 4 is only interested in himself. He worships himself. He's interested in his own estate, his own material possessions, how many wives he can get. And that's all he cares about. So one thing that God has given us is this great contrast between the Lamech of Genesis 4 and the Lamech of Genesis 5, who, because of his godly example as a father, raised a godly son that you can read about, whose name has really lasted through 4,000 years of history and is known even to people who aren't Christians, who don't study the Bible. Our identity will continue long after our time, to our kids, maybe even if you don't have kids, to people that you influence, maybe people that you're figuratively, spiritually a father or a mother to. So that's our reminder today from genealogies. Pray with me, please. God, we thank you for what you've given us. And I pray that for most of us in this room who do like to read and study the Bible, who see it as you speaking directly to us, I pray that for those of us who do that regularly, you'd help us not to skim read, not to skip over genealogies, to, yes, to struggle with the pronunciation of names, but at the same time to look for what you want to teach us. Maybe with the same interest that we look at a family tree from a family Bible, if we knew that those were our ancestors 100 years ago. May we have that interest and passion and investigative drive as we look at Genesis 5 and 11, Matthew chapter 1, 1 Chronicles chapter 1. Help us, God, to reflect, to look in the mirror and ask ourselves the deep questions. What do we worship? What do we care about? What do we desire? What do we value? And how is that influencing other people around us? So God, we pray that you would take our lives and our families and our extended family, this church, and that you would help us to live lives such that people would say, this person, this man, this woman, this single person who is not married, this whole family, this church is one that walks after God and cares about him. And because of that, also a church and a family and an individual that cares about other people, especially the poor and the needy. So give us thoughts of Christ this day and help us worship as we sing once again. Amen.